Call the Civil Law Committee to order. Quorum is present. Representative Hortman moves to reconsider the motion that passed the minutes of March 14th, 2012. Is that correct, Representative Hortman?
Yes,
that's correct.
I would like to move those amended minutes.
Well, we're going to move to reconsider the motion that whereby they passed.
I'd like to move to reconsider that.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Representative Hortman, you'd like to move, you found a correction that needed to be made. We would just move then to amend that motion whereby they passed to substitute the minutes that have been handed out to the committee members today. Is that?
Mr. Chair, I really liked the idea that there were 97 Democrats on this committee and only 9 Republicans, but I thought that might be a typo. So.
Is that that's your motion, Representative Hortman?
That's my motion.
Where do you store them all, Representative Hortman? So we'll move to amend the March 14th minutes and replace them with the copy that's been handed out today and to all committee members. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved for March 14th as amended. March 19th minutes. Representative Drazkowski wants to move the March 19th minutes.
Any question, Mr.
Representative Hortman.
Representative Drazkowski, have you read the March 19th minutes?
Don't ask questions that you don't always know the answer to, Representative.
I just thought that's why the vice chair got paid so much extra.
Representative Drazkowski, you've been asked a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I believe this is the version that Ms. Novosinski and I went through. And so that answer be yes, Representative Hortman.
Representative Hortman, any other questions?
No, Mr. Chair.
We won't ask you the question. any discussion, members, on the approval of the March 19th, 2012 minutes? No discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Davids, welcome to our committee. You've got Senate File 1934.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Drazkowski moves SF 1934 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Is that correct, Representative Davids?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Tell us about your bill, Representative Davids, and members. We've got 3 bills we need to get through today. Hopefully this we can, I know there's some people that want to testify, and Representative Davids, if we can try to stay to 45 minutes total, we'll ask both sides to try to stay to 10 to 15 minutes to present their issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you, Representative Drazkowski, for moving House File Senate File Number 1934. What I'm going to do, Mr. Chairman, is turn it over to Marcus Marsh with the Minnesota Township Mutual Association to describe the bill, and then we've got a few folks like testify on behalf of the bill.
Mr. Marsh, welcome to our committee. And
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
If I might, our House research document is written to the House File 2342, first engrossment, and we have the Senate file in our packet. Are they the same?
They should.
Just a second.
Chair.
Mr. Marsh.
They should be the same. The bill, if it has, or it should have final day of enactment, it should be the same.
Just a second here. We'll ask House Research.
They should be identical.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe the summary is still accurate to the bill, the Senate version of the bill.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Holberg, the Senate has passed this bill off the floor, so that's the reason we got the Senate file.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but sometimes what the Senate does and what the House does is actually different, and so given that the
correct
research summary was written to the House file, I wanted to make sure.
Very good. Mr. Marsh, welcome to the committee, and how many testifiers do you have, Representative Davids and Mr. Marsh?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, other than Mr. Marsh, would be three.
Three, very okay. Brief. Can we stick within 15 minutes, Mr. Marsh?
Yep, we will
in total
do what we need to do, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Go ahead, identify yourself for the committee. You guys can allocate time accordingly.
My name is Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutual Insurance Association. We are a trade association made up of 93 farm mutuals across the state and some statewide partners that we buy reinsurance and package other lines with. The bill before you, Senate file 1934, is a bill that is correcting an issue that happened in the State Court of Appeals. It relates to our farm policy, which is now a homeowner's policy, and a court decision in regards to our provision of 1 year to bring litigation in our farm policy, which is different than a homeowner's policy. And our homeowner's policy, like everybody's homeowner's policy, follows 65A, where the farm policy works in Minnesota Statute 67A. The people that will be testifying first will be Mikkel Nelson from Elmdale Farmers Mutual in Uppsala, and then Richard Ron, Manager Woodland Mutual in Carlton, giving more insight into the policy and the issue than I can. And then finally, Paul Wilken, who's our legal counsel from Willenbring Dahl and Wilken in Cold Spring. I also want to mention, Mr. Chair, we have a nice delegation of managers from our 93 member companies across the state. So nice group over here. You can raise your hand or something. We got a nice group of folks in because this is such an important issue for agriculture, for farm insurance across greater Minnesota, that they're here to lend their support today on this important bill for us.
And thank so you. Welcome to our Civil Law Committee.
Thank you. With that, we'll have Mikkel Nelson come up.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I would like to go through a little bit.
Pause. I need to have you identify yourself for the taped record that we keep here. So
my name is Mikkel Nelson, M-I-K-E-L. I'm the manager of Elmdale Farmers Mutual at Uppsala, Minnesota.
Very good. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we need to try to keep it all within 15, so that's if you can keep that in mind.
Yes, sir. What I'd like to tell you a little bit about is who our companies are and who we represent. We are very small insurance companies. Our smallest member has about $149,000 a year in annual premium, and they insure about 220 properties. That's tiny. Our largest member has about $3.5 million of premium, and our largest policyholder count in the state is about 5,600. Remember, you're spreading that over 84 of the township mutual companies that are right in Minnesota. So we are the smallest of the small. This is not Prudential. This is not New York Life. Excuse me. These are the small rural agents, rural companies. We all employ two or three people in our offices. This is greater Minnesota at its finest. One thing I would like to share with you is we put together some claims data, and over the last 5 years, we have an estimate of we've had somewhere in the area of 41,000 claims that our little companies have paid over the last 5 years, and that's somewhere in excess of $150 million that we paid out in the rural community, both to the rural farmers, the rural property owners. We think that's a fairly significant piece that we're doing out there. 90% of the business we write is rural. Some of our companies are near the metro. We're prohibited by statute from writing in greater Minneapolis. So we're not downtown trying to write the big buildings. We're out in the country writing farms. That's what we do. Again, that's who we are. That's where we're from. Does anyone on the committee have a question for me on that?
Mr. Nelson, I'd like to get through the testifiers, and then members can write their questions down, and we'll get into discussion once we've concluded all that. So we might call you back. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marsh, next. Okay. Welcome to our committee. Identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
My name is Richard Ron. I'm the manager of the Woodland Mutual Insurance Company in Carlton, Minnesota. I'd like to thank the committee for allowing us to speak today, and I'll keep my remarks brief as I can and still cover the materials that I would like. I'm not here today to retry any individual court case. I would like to mention that our bill, the bill proposed, does not impact homeowners insurance. The subject of the lawsuit that brought this bill about was a working farm. And the intent of this bill is only to put the township mutual industry back on the basis it was prior to the court decision. Nothing new is being asked for. The impact of the court decision extends far beyond how a loss is settled. It restricts the ability of a township mutual to underwrite property and accept risks. The restricted ability may reduce the availability of insurance in rural issues, which may lead consumers finding it difficult to obtain insurance or to buy insurance at higher rates. It overturns over 50 years of case law, underwriting practices, and rate structures. It leaves consumers and companies in an unworkable situation as the cancellation provisions. Part of a premises, the home, is subject to one set of cancellation rules, and the other part, the farm, is subject to another set. What is to be done when these two parts overlap? This is a confusing situation for both consumer and company. The court decision raises many more questions than it answers. Township mutuals play a vital role in the insurance market in rural Minnesota. They focus on rural areas and primarily smaller towns. Township mutuals insure a wide variety of property risks, from full farm operations to small seasonal cottages throughout rural Minnesota. Working in areas often with no building codes, township mutuals are presented with and insure unique risks. Collectively, they provide insurance products to over 65% of the farm market in Minnesota. Collectively, they provide the Minnesota consumers with a real buffer from market price swings and insurance availability. By statute, they focus solely on the Minnesota consumer. They write insurance in no other states. The legislature has historically recognized the unique nature of township mutuals and the risks they insure. As a result, the legislature has a long history of recognizing and respecting the unique statutes under which they operate. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Ronning. The last person you have? Welcome to our committee. Identify yourself for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Woken. I'm an attorney in Cold Spring, Minnesota, and I have the privilege to represent many of the township mutuals in courts throughout the state of Minnesota over the past 35 years. I will also keep my remarks brief, and I want to start by indicating to the members of the committee that the proposed revisions to the statute in this bill are intended to clarify MSA 67A-191. The proposed revisions do not seek to change any existing law, nor are the proposed revisions intended to implement any new law. The revision to subdivision 1 of 67A-191 would simply clarify current law by specifically stating that the portions of a combination policy that a township mutual issues on qualified property includes dwellings. That is not a new or novel issue in Minnesota, and I would hope that members of the committee who are considering passage of this bill would give consideration to 67A14 subdivision 1, which already defines what qualified property is, which is what township mutuals insure. That statute says and defines qualified property as including dwellings, household goods, farm buildings, outbuildings, that kind of thing. So by including the language in the revision to subdivision 1, we're simply restating and reincorporating the language of 67A14 into 67A191, which again does not represent anything new or any new legislation or new rule of law. Now the proposed revision to section 2 of 67A191 is also intended for the same purpose, to provide clarification so that when a township mutual does issue a homeowner's policy, that policy, as Mr. Ron indicated to the committee, would still be subject to the rules of 65A that govern the large insurance companies. However, that revision to subdivision 2 would reaffirm that in the case of a combination policy, farm policy, issued by a township mutual, that those policies are exempt from the laws of Minnesota and that they qualify as qualified property, including dwellings. So the revisions to the two statutes, members of the committee, again, is an attempt to clarify existing statutory and case law, which is embodied under 67A.14. Now, as has been mentioned, this bill was prompted by a court case which is currently under appeal, and I don't have any desire to go into a long discussion about that case, but I want to emphasize that it's our view that this bill would have no effect, no impact on the current litigation that is under appeal before the state Supreme Court. The clarifications that we're asking for under the Township Mutual policy is really at the heart of what the language in 67A14 and 67A191 stand for, and the long-standing rule and case law in Minnesota has been that Township Mutuals, because they are limited in terms of the coverage area where they can write insurance and the kinds of insurance that they're able to issue, that they have severe restrictions placed on them historically, and for that reason, in part, 67A has long recognized that they have a unique and special status in that the insurance laws of Minnesota do not apply to them unless a specific statute states otherwise. This bill would not change any of that existing case law. One final comment.
Mr. Workman, about 4 minutes left.
Okay. You're going to hear from some speakers in the audience who are going to come up and, I believe, tell you about the litigation that was involved in this case, which is now under appeal. I just want to let the committee know that this case was the result of a difference of opinion between a township mutual and a policyholder as to what the actual cash value of that insured's dwelling was. Pursuant to current Minnesota law and the provisions of the township mutual policy, that issue went to an appraisal process by agreement between the company and the policyholder. It was resolved by way of the appraisal process, and the township mutual, following an award made by that appraisal process, paid in excess of $820,000 to this policyholder for the loss to the dwelling, personal property, and household goods. Following that payment, on the last day of a two-year period following the date of the loss, the policyholder brought suit arguing for the first time that this policy was a homeowner's policy under subdivision 2 of 67A191 subdivision 2, and therefore valued policy law applied. And as most of you folks I'm sure know already, valued policy law simply says that if you pay for a certain level of insurance, the amount of that coverage that's stated in the policy is the amount paid if there's a complete and total loss, regardless of the value of the structure. Now, long-standing case law in Minnesota from our Supreme Court has held that under the protection of 67A that township mutuals enjoy, valued policy law does not apply and never has applied to township mutuals. Ehlert versus Grau was a Supreme Court case handed down in 1972. So when you hear from subsequent speakers who tell you that the issue in this case is that the policyholder purchased a certain level of insurance coverage on his house. That's not the issue in this case, and that's not the purpose for these revisions. These revisions have nothing to do with the issue of value policy law, but are instead intended to provide clarification as to what qualified property is that Township Mutuals may write. And again, and lastly, I'll make this my last comment, we already have that language in 67A14 subdivision 1. We're asking this committee to consider a bill that would restate that and clarify that in the context of 67A191. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkin. Members, if you have questions, I would ask you to write them down. We will allow that. We have three other testifiers in opposition that we'll have come present to our committee, and then we'll ask questions. Mr. White, is it? And Mr. Caesar, you two together? And Mr. White, I don't know if you're kind of... We have one more person besides the two of you. Sharon Betzinger, do you know her? Or is she part of, with you, or Sharon, are you here?
Yes, she is, but she will not be testifying.
She's not testifying. It's you two. Okay. We'll need to keep within 15 minutes. Mr. White, Mr. Caesar, however you want to present, that's fine with us. Please identify yourself for the record, and then we'll allow committee members to ask questions of you or the prior testifiers once we've concluded your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David White.
If you can pull the microphone a little closer, it would be better.
Excuse me. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. My name is David White, W-E-I-D-T. I'm an attorney from Minneapolis. I represent Michael Caesar and Sharon Betzinger, who were the homeowners and the claimants in the Court of Appeals case that has been brought up by Mr. Walken in reference to the pending legislation. Mr. Walken has told you what he thinks you should know about this legislation and the effect of it. He's made references to our case and told you some things about our case. I'm going to tell you some more things about our case and about this legislation. As Mr. Walken indicated, the Township Mutual companies are exempt from Minnesota insurance statutes unless there is specific legislation, a specific statute that applies to Township Mutual insurance companies. There is in this case. It's 67A.191 subdivision 2. That statute says that in the case of a homeowner's insurance policy, I'm not going to read you the statute, but I will paraphrase it, and I'm sure that I'll be corrected if I do it incorrectly. Says that if the Township Mutual Company issues a homeowner's policy as defined by Minnesota statutes, that policy is subject to statute 65A, which is the Minnesota statute that covers fire insurance policies and standard fire insurance policies. The two issues that that are relevant to our particular case and I think are the basis of this legislation are that the homeowner's insurance policy under 65A provides for the value policy law to be in effect and also provides for a two-year statute of limitations. Now, Mr. Walken talked briefly about what the value policy law is. What it says is that if you have a fire insurance policy with a certain limit of coverage, you have a total loss of your property, that you are entitled to the entire amount of coverage that you've purchased under this policy. This is what happened in this case. There clearly was a total loss. There clearly was a fire. There clearly was a policy limit. That policy limit was in excess of $550,000. The issue was whether the policy that the claimants had was a homeowner's policy, and as such was subject to this value policy law, and they were entitled to the full amount of their coverage. Initially, there was a denial of that by the insurance company. They went through a procedure, as Mr. Watkin had described, that that procedure was not final. The claimants had a right to bring additional litigation, which they did, seeking the full benefit of the premiums that they had paid and the policy they had bought from the insurance company. Now, the two-year statute of limitations is also under 65A. So if this is found to be a homeowner's policy and that the statute that I cited is applicable, then both the two-year statute of limitations would apply and the value policy law. We went to the trial court in Pine County. Pine County trial court ruled that it was not, that the one-year statute of limitations was applicable and did not address the issue of whether this was a homeowner's policy or not. Our position was that they erred in that. We went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals took the position that, in fact, this was a homeowner's policy under the plain language of the statute, thus subject to the two-year statute of limitations. The value policy law was not an issue at the Court of Appeals either. So that wasn't directly addressed. The question is: Are these things a two-year statute of limitations and a value policy law and homeowners insurance something unusual or radical or unfair to ask the insurance companies to abide by? I don't think so. Every insurance company in Minnesota that's not a township mutual insurance company is abides by it as a matter of course. In 1994, the Minnesota legislature adopted 67A.191, included subdivision 2, which said that if it's a homeowner's policy, and it defined a homeowner's policy as it's defined in 65A, as it's a package of coverages typically sold to homeowners, that the homeowner was then entitled to 65A and all of the benefits that are within that statute. Now, it didn't say unless it's on a farm; it said a homeowner's policy. It didn't define it any further than the Minnesota statutes already defined it. The value policy law has been in effect in Minnesota since 1967. If you look at the original legislation in 1967, if you look at what's in effect today, it hasn't changed a bit. The value policy law is in effect in 20 states in the United States. It's in effect in Wisconsin, North and South Dakota. In fact, it's been in effect in Wisconsin. It was originally adopted in Wisconsin in the 1870s. So this is not something that came up recently. The two-year statute of limitations for bringing an action on a fire loss is actually a compromise from the normal 6-year statute of limitations on a contract action. And that compromise was granted to all insurance companies as part of the adoption of 65A years ago. I can't tell you what year, but at least 1967, which is now 45 years ago. I'd like to give you briefly an example of what the difference is between these two interpretations, whether this is a homeowner's policy or not. In the case of Michael Caesar and Sharon Betzinger, they purchased a policy that had coverage of approximately $440,000. Somebody from the insurance company came out to their house and looked at it, put a valuation on it, said, "This is the amount of insurance that you need to fully cover your house." They paid it. They took that insurance. They paid the premium. A year later, somebody came out again, I believe the same person, and said, "Now your house is worth $557,300. They raised the policy limit. They paid the premium as they were advised. Within that year, the house burned down on April 23rd, 2008. There was no dispute of any sort about the fire, only the value that the insurance company needed to pay. 3 months after the fire, on July 29th, 2008, the insurance company offered their insureds $361,000, $196,000 less than the policy premium that they had paid and the limit of the policy that they had that could and should have been paid under 67A.191. On March 18th, 2009, almost 11 months after the fire, the appraisal process was gone through. Through that process, there was a determination of the actual cash value of the property to be $445,655, $112,000 less than the amount due under the value policy law and the amount that they had paid the premiums on. This appraisal was not a final proceeding. The claimants had a right to continue to and bring litigation if they were dissatisfied with that result. They did. We sought relief from the court. They're simply seeking the benefit of the policy that they bought and paid for, and that's dictated by the plain language of the statute. Now, the testimony that you heard earlier said that this is a very important issue and suggested by implication that something bad was going to happen to these insurance companies if they are required to pay benefits according to 65A and if they are required to grant a two-year statute of limitations for litigating fire losses. There was no specific indication of anything other than speculation that there would be any negative effect at all. And the whole basis of the argument seems to be that somehow this whole system of township mutual companies will be placed in jeopardy if the insurance companies are required to pay fire losses according to the law. This is a law that's been in effect since 1994. The insurance companies are claiming that there's some confusion about it. There's something that is hard to understand. The Court of Appeals said this is simply the application of the plain language of the policy. And it's been in effect since 1994, and it hasn't gotten any more or less complicated since then.
Okay, Mr. White, can you finish up?
Yes. In summary, I'd just like to say the purpose of this litigation is to clarify, and if you look at the litigation that's been, or excuse me, if you look at the statute that's put in front of you and you look at what it does to subdivision 2, it appears to say that under a homeowner's policy that's subject to 65A, if that homeowner's policy includes a home, then it's not subject to 65A. I would submit that causes more confusion than it clarifies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Caesar, if you proceed, introduce yourself for the record and proceed, and if we'd like to limit it to about 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Michael Caesar. I am the homeowner in this situation and the reason why we're all here today. I had purchased a policy from the insurance company, which was a township mutual, back in, let's say, 05. In the process, I was in building a new house on my farm. The insurance agent came out, set the base price, which at that time was $400,000 and change. We finished the house. The same insurance agent came back out, reappraised the house. A year later, which would have been about the year of 2007, she came out and said, well, geez, the rate, you know, value of everything's going up. We need to increase the rates of your house, which she set it at $557,000. Not once have I asked them to come out and raise my rate, raise my values, plus my premiums. A year later, the fire happened. We lost everything we owned in that house. It came to, we brought a motion against we brought the claim against the insurance company. They, in return, turned it over to their legal counsel, which is Walken, Dahlberg, and someone else, if I don't get me wrong. we dealt back and forth. It was literally a battle for the first year, almost the first year, before we finally got an appraisal done on the house. I lived in a camper trailer for 18 months till after we got it resolved. Then there came the winter, and then finally the following spring, I was able to build. We went back and forth with the insurance company, from them offering a full check for the $557,000 to the day I received it in the mailbox, the insurance company rescinding it, to offering me a check for half of that amount and then rescinding that one. It was a lot of ups and downs all the way through this whole process. Finally, we went to appraisal. And mind you, when you look at a house and value a house, you have a beautiful house standing there. Everything is picturesque. Now, when you go do an appraisal...
Mr. Caesar, about a minute left.
The house is basically down in the ground. How can you appraise a house that is burnt into a basement? Went through the appraisal process. That's how we ended up at district court. We ended up into appeals court because we reappealed it. The appeals court sided with us. It was in clear language that it fell underneath a 65A, which my attorney explained to you. On my package, it was a deluxe combination package policy. Never once written in there a farm policy in the headline, in the subtitles, until you got back about 10 pages into the policy, then it stated what the farm was. First of all, on that deck sheet and everything else was the house. I don't know how many of you have an insurance policy on your home at home, but in my opinion, please bring it to an attorney and have it looked at, because what's hidden in there in fine print, after something happens, it's a little too late to know what you're actually covered for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caesar. Is there anybody else that would like to testify in favor or against the bill? Hearing none, we'll open up for questions from members. Representative Lesh.
My question, Mr. Chair, was for one of the guys who testified for the bill. And it was just a brief question of, there were certain areas that were excluded from selling to. I thought you said Greater Minneapolis or something. But is it a specific set geographic region or counties? Where can you not sell? Where can you sell?
Mr. Marsh.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the way the township mutuals are set up used to be was you specified by townships. That's where they originally got their name, and they're limited. And I know this is kind of foreign to some of the metro legislators, but you actually spelled out the number of townships that you could sell in. And at one point, it was only 150 townships. That's how small and localized the member companies were. If those of you that have been here 3 or 4 years remember, actually, the Department of Commerce and Jackie Gardner, who is a very, very good person over there to work with, came with a modernization proposal trying to simplify this, and we go by counties. And so now, in the top end, our biggest company can sell in 20 counties, and it's down all the way to one county. It's based on reserves that was set by the Department of Commerce. So we have a few township mutuals or farm mutuals that sell in only one county, and a few sell in 20. And I'd say, I think on average, it's probably 8 to 10 counties.
Okay.
And we're prohibited by statute of selling in cities of the first class.
Representative Lesh.
Okay, thank you. Can you sell in counties that include a city of the first class?
Mr. Marsh.
To my understanding, we can sell in cities of the second class, and the law was changed in the Modernization Act. We actually took out cities of the first class, and the department put in a number of up to 150,000. But you had to be grandfathered into initially second-class cities. For quite a long period, we could not even sell in cities of the second class, unless they were grandfathered in because they sold in that community before it became a city of the second class.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, let's say I can sell in under the terms of my, I don't know if it's a license from the Department of Commerce or what, but I can sell in Fillmore and Maurer and Olmsted or something, but my business increases, so I want to sell in other adjacent counties. How do I do that?
Mr. Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. What is done is that you have to go through a process including financial information, business plan and a host of things with the Department of Commerce if you want to add an additional county or counties. And once you meet with the Department of Commerce, they look through all your financial information. They'll make a determination whether they approve it or not approve it.
Okay. That is my
Representative
question.
Lesch. Sure. Is that it?
I have no more questions.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question probably for the attorneys, and I'm sure they might have different answers on some of this. I guess the first question I have is the status of the litigation. So there was a Court of Appeals decision. I assume that the Supreme Court has accepted review, or is it still in the petition for review process, or what?
We'll have legal counsel respond.
No.
Grab a chair, please. So we'll get you on the record. And I'm sorry, I stepped out. Your name again is Mr.
It's Wolken, not Walken.
Mr. Wolken, go ahead.
Representative, in response to your question, the Court of Appeals issued their decision, filed them on January 13th. Mm-hmm. Under the rules of civil procedure, we filed our petition for discretionary review. It's still in front of the Supreme Court. They have not made a decision yet. We understand that that should be coming very soon. But I want to underscore very quickly, if I can, that we don't view the revisions under this bill as affecting in any way the outcome of this litigation. That's not a possibility.
Representative Simon.
Before I hear from Mr. White, too, I'm sure you might have a different interpretation, but just objective questions. Was it a yeah, you can.
Okay.
Yeah, you could, Mr. White, you can grab a chair as well.
So, I guess my question is, what is the name of the case? Because is this, Mr. Chair, where is this going next?
It's going to the General Register, okay. Representative Simon.
I mean, it's an interesting issue. We might want to take a look at it. What's the name of the case? Does it have a citation, or just the name would be fine, I guess.
Mr. White or Mr. Wolken? Mr. Wolken.
Michael Cisar et al. Appellants.
How do you spell that?
Michael Cisar, C-I-S-A-R, Appellants. Versus Lisa J. Slyter et al. Respondents. It's S-L-Y-T-E-R.
Okay.
And Springvale Mutual Insurance Company respondents.
Okay.
Representative Simon?
And might I ask, was it a unanimous opinion or was there a split?
Mr. Wolken.
This was a three-judge panel and it was a unanimous opinion.
So,
Simon,
thank you. So, I'll take a look at the case. But so, the bill arises out of the case, but doesn't undo or affect the case. Is that? Am I getting that right? I just want to make sure I understand the relationship of the bill. You might. I suspect you both have different opinions on this, but.
Well,
Mr. Wolken,
my opinion, Representative, is that if the committee were to pass the bill. And it were to ultimately become law in Minnesota, obviously with respect to this particular case, it would not have any bearing or impact on the court's decision, assuming the Supreme Court certifies it. And my position would be that the Supreme Court, even in the event of passage, would obviously apply the law in effect at the time of the cause of action. So it really has no impact in terms of affecting Mr. Cisar personally.
Other questions, Representative Simon?
Yeah, just one. And this area is new to me, so forgive me here. The valued policy law, is that really, that's the main issue. I heard that raises an issue. Is that the main issue here? Maybe the case will say that when I look at it. But
Mr. White?
Well, both the two-year statute of limitations and the value policy law are contained within 65A.
Right.
And the issue of the statute of limitations came into play because our claim was brought within 2 years but not within 1 year. If 65A was not applicable, then we would have failed to meet a one-year statute of limitations and the case would have and should have been dismissed under those circumstances. And that was the decision of the trial court. But if it is a township mutual, if it is a homeowner's policy under 67A.91 subdivision 2, then it's subject to 65A, which would be both the two-year statute and the value policy law. And, of course, the value policy law is what would mandate the additional payment of about $110,000 to my clients based on the applicability of the value policy law.
Representative Simon?
Just two quick ones. So then, Mr. Wokin, you mentioned that obviously you're going to be arguing that the Court of Appeals got it wrong, and you mentioned a 1972 Supreme Court case. That's basically your argument, that the Court of Appeals got it wrong, Supreme Court should correct this. What I assume that case is cited in the other case, right?
Mr. Wokin.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Could I just respond very briefly, though? Because the question was, this is all about value policy law. And, of course, the respondents in this case are attempting to make that the issue in the case. Is the policy in Minnesota, or should the policy of Minnesota be that township mutuals, even though we've had case law and this rule for 90-plus years, that valued policy law doesn't apply to township mutuals, the argument that's being made by the opposition to this bill is that that should be the law in Minnesota. That was not the issue in this case. It's not the issue behind this bill. And I just want to clarify from the members of the committee that what we are attempting to do by these revisions is to simply clarify the language of 67A191 by incorporating what is already found in 67A14, which defines qualified property, which is the property the township mutuals are allowed by statute to write. And under that statute, 67A14 subdivision 1, it defines qualified property as including dwellings. And that's why township mutuals for decades have been writing combination farm policies like this one under subdivision 1, which recognizes under that statute a distinction between a homeowner's policy and a farm combination policy that includes a dwelling or a house and has the protection from the insurance laws of Minnesota, which has been the law in Minnesota for many years.
I think that context is helpful, Mr. Wokin. Representative Simon.
Representative Simon, if
Mr.
I could,
White.
If I may just address the issue of the 1972 case. The 67A.191 was adopted by the Minnesota legislature in 1994, 20 years later. So the Supreme Court's decision in the 70s that 65A and the value policy law is not applicable to township mutuals was specifically overridden by the legislature in 1994 when they passed this 67A.191 subdivision 2 that specifically said that a homeowner's policy is covered by statute 65A. And I'd like to say that we've made no argument that the homeowner that 65A is applicable because there's a dwelling. We've made the argument that it's applicable because there's a homeowner's policy. And 67A.191 says a homeowner's policy as it's defined. And a homeowner's policy is defined in the statute, and again I'll paraphrase, as a package of coverages that are typically sold to homeowners. Whether there's a dwelling, by definition that would include a dwelling, but homeowners, a dwelling is not necessarily homeowner's coverage if it doesn't include that package of coverages. At the trial court and at the Court of Appeals, we presented an expert opinion from a public adjuster who's been in this business a long enough time that we felt that his opinion would hold merit with the court. The Court of Appeals recognized that and recognized his opinion that the policy of these people was in fact a homeowner's policy, and that opinion had been not rebutted in any fashion by the other parties. I'd like to talk a little bit, if I could, Representative, about the effect of this bill on the pending case. If you take the sheet that you've been given and turn it over, there's one line on the back, the effective date. It says this section is effective the day following final enactment. Now, if this case goes to the Supreme Court, or if it doesn't go to the Supreme Court, in all likelihood, at some point, it will possibly be dismissed by the Supreme Court. But if it's not, it will be remanded back to the District Court in Pine County. And my concern is when it gets back to the district court that it may, the Pine County or the trial court may take the position that this new statute, if in fact it's passed, is applicable to this case. Now, if this committee wants to enact the intent that has been expressed by Mr. Wolkin, that language could be changed. It could be say it could say that it's applicable to losses that occurred after a certain date, and that date would not exclude my client's loss. There's any number of different languages that could put that could be put in that would make it clear that it's not applicable to not only our claim but other claims that have happened prior to the enactment of this law, should it become law. And I would ask the committee to clearly, since Mr. Wolkin has expressed the intent of the drafters, that to make that change so that there's no possibility that this whatever you would finally enact, if there's something enacted, that it would be applicable to our pending case and other pending cases, because we have no idea how many other similar claims could be out there.
Representative Simon, any other questions?
That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I think, is for the author and the first proponent of the bill, but it may be for maybe first I should direct my question to Mr. Gehring. I'm looking at lines 1.17 through 1.19 of the bill. It says all this is not proposed to be changed. This is existing law. It says all portions of the combination policy providing homeowners insurance, including those issued by a township mutual insurance company, are subject to the provisions of 65A. That seems pretty clear to me. And then the new language that we're proposing to add, starting at line 1.20 to 1.23, refers to different policies. It doesn't sound like it refers to homeowners policies. It says the portions of all combination policies issued by township mutual insurance companies insuring qualified and secondary property, including those that insure dwellings, but we're not calling those homeowners policies, whether or not owner-occupied under the authority of Subdivision 1, are exempt from the requirements of this subdivision. To me, what does that language mean, Mr. Gehring, particularly the language, are exempt from the requirements of this subdivision? Which subdivision and which policies are we saying are exempt from which subdivision?
Mr. Gehring, can you clarify for us?
If that question was at all clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I'm not an expert on insurance law at all. I think the reference to this subdivision would refer to policies issued under subdivision 2. Further clarification about the intent of that language might be better addressed to the author, I think.
Representative Portman?
Sure. To Representative Davids and his primary proponent for the bill, it just seems like in this paragraph of subdivision 2, the new proposed paragraph, we're creating conflict and a lack of clarity where right now, to me, it looks like there is clarity.
Mr.
So
Wolkin.
If you could just explain what this language is supposed to do.
Mr. Wolkin.
Thank you, Representative. Certainly that was not the intent, but in answer to your question, what that last part of that underlined revision refers to is the requirements of the subdivision. We're talking about subdivision 2. So, in effect, the underlined revision is really mirroring the one in subdivision 1. What we're simply saying in subdivision 1 is that township mutuals can write combination package policies, as they have for decades and decades, farm combination package policies on qualified property. And qualified property means dwellings, because we take that from 67A14. And then in subdivision 2, we're repeating that and saying that in the instance, because of significance under this bill, is that this statute recognizes that there's a distinction between a homeowner's policy and a combination farm package policy. That's why we've got two subdivisions. And the revision under subdivision 2 is intended to say that when a township mutual writes a homeowner's policy, a township mutual will be governed by 65A, and that has always been the law. However, if it is written in a combination farm package policy that includes a dwelling, then it will be exempt from subdivision 2, which forces the township mutuals to follow the provisions of 65A. So that's the distinction.
Representative Mr. Chair, well, then I would suggest that the language doesn't do clearly what you want it to do. What Subdivision 2 is titled is homeowners' risks, and what you're talking about changing the law is applied to combination policies that include dwelling coverage but that are not homeowner policies. And it seems like Subdivision 2 says what a person's rights are when they have homeowners insurance. And it sounds like maybe this case, I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, turns on whether or not this was a homeowner's policy or a combination policy.
Absolutely.
And what the bill excuse me, is trying to do is to make clear how those combination policies will be treated. So it seems like that should be a different, it should be Subdivision 3, combination policies, including dwellings, and then say whatever you think the law is applying to those combination policies. But the way that the bill is written, we're saying homeowners' policies are subject to 65A, but then some other kind of policies aren't subject to 65A or this subdivision. It just, it creates internal conflict, and I think makes it even more unclear.
Mr. Wilkin, do you concur with Representative Hortman's concern here in
the
language?
I guess all I can say is what I've said previously, and that was certainly not the intent. What we were trying to do in that particular language was, again, I suppose one could argue that we're guilty of being redundant in the sense that we're, in effect, repeating the revision that we're putting in Subdivision 1. Mm-hmm. And I think that the intent would still flow if that particular addition or revision to Subdivision 2 were deleted.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I think I probably could support your bill if it were amended to have in two ways. One, to create a Subdivision 3 that deals with these combination policies, because that's what you're trying to clarify. And two, if you consider adding language at the end of the effective date that says, and applies to losses that occur after this date. Because I don't think that we here in this committee want to be drafting a bill that impacts a case that's going before the Minnesota Supreme Court, and we don't know all the facts, and we certainly are not equipped to get into that here. But and I know you probably don't want to amend it on the fly here in committee. I don't think that's the best way to change language in a bill. But I just offer those thoughts as ways that I think you could probably make your bill better and clearer and get my support.
Okay, members, we're going to continue to discuss in hopefully a little more rapid fire order, and then I think the intention is to lay it over and have the author and others look at it and bring it back tomorrow. Representative Davids, does that work for you?
Mr. Chairman, what time is the meeting tomorrow?
Same time, same place, Mr. Chair.
That'd be fine with me.
Okay. Other questions for the testifiers while they're here? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Hilty wanted to speak to this exact amendment that Representative Hortman was talking about, so it might be more appropriate to take him next, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, in light of the testimony from Mr. Wilkin about the intent and the ambiguity that seems to surround that, I would actually like to move an oral amendment at this time.
Mr. Chairman.
Basically what Representative Hortman.
Just a second, Representative Hilty, just a moment. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could move to lay this over until tomorrow, because rather than doing amendments on the fly, I'd like the affected parties to be able to visit a little bit and try to come with some resolution rather than going through amendments. I know you've got two other bills up, and I want to respect the committee's time.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Hilty, does that work for you? Could you work with the author?
Mr. Chair, we may be confusing the track that Representative Hortman was on with my intent, which was simply to clarify the issue about whether this would apply to this case or not, simple amendment, and at least I would like Mr. Gehring to read the proposed amendment before we make a decision about that.
Okay, we'll do that, Representative Hilty. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment from Representative Hilty would be page 2, line 1, before the period, insert, comma, and apply to losses incurred on or after that date, So the whole effective date would read, the section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to losses incurred on or after that date.
So Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wolken, could you, is this could be part of the discussion, I suspect, that you and Representative Davids and others could discuss between now and tomorrow at 12:30?
Yes.
Representative Hilty, is that okay with you? I think that's back to Representative Hortman's concern. There's certainly a desire to iron that out.
Mr. Chair, I think it's clear that there are other issues involved here, but I think this is a pretty straightforward one. And if there's some way in which this doesn't clarify the issue and provide the comfort that Mr. Wolken was intending to provide to us, I don't quite understand what that is.
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Representative Davids.
If I could ask Mr. Gehring a question. The way the language is currently in the bill, do you believe that it would affect any future or any court cases that are currently going on?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I think because we use the phrase losses incurred on or after that date, it would only apply to if you don't have a loss right now. And it,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gehring, I'm talking about the way the language is in the bill currently, not the amendment.
Lot line 2.1, Mr. Gehring.
2.1. It's not my intent, Mr. Chairman, to affect current court case, but does the language we have do that?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, it probably is a little ambiguous the way it's written right now about whether it would affect the current litigation.
Let's go with Representative Hilty's oral amendment, and if you'll read it again. Representative Hilty moves an oral amendment, and Mr. Gehring, would you read the amendment again, please?
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment is page 2, line 1, after enactment, insert comma, and applies to losses incurred on or after that date. So the whole effective date reads, this section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to losses incurred on or after that date.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Any discussion on the amendment as presented? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and to the committee and to the members, to the author of the bill. I'm relatively uncomfortable doing any kind of a bill that will have an impact on a pending Supreme Court bill, a case, for a variety of reasons. Every time, I think it's called the law of unintended consequences, and when we do something here, it always affects how it's done at the courts. I'm kind of looking at, because I have tried to figure out how you affect the Supreme Court, and I've been stymied every time. I can't remember the last time we put a bill into effect that essentially affected or dealt with a case in front of the Supreme Court as it is hearing it or looking to hear it. So I'm very uncomfortable with this bill. For that reason, Representative Davids, and I tend to like some of your bills, so I'm reluctant to say this. So for that reason, I don't like this amendment. I don't really particularly like this bill as it's written, and I would maybe support it next year after the Supreme Court so we could actually deal with the Supreme Court's decision. But right now, we're dealing with hypotheticals and maybes and possibilities. And when we tend to do that as legislators, we tend to have unintended consequences that are a mess 6 months or 6 years down the road. So with that, I will allow the let's vote.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Other discussion on the amendment? Representative Mazeroff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, if I understand the intent of the oral amendment, I think we want to add the word only after applies and applies only to claims or whatever the rest of the bill should say.
Would you take that as a friendly amendment to your amendment, Representative Hilty?
hear Mr. Gehring's opinion of that, if I understand what's being proposed.
Mr. Gehring, would you read it with that only in there to let us hear what it sounds like?
Mr. Chair, so I believe that the oral amendment would then read This section is effective the day following final enactment and applies only to losses incurred on or after that date.
That makes sense, Mr. Chair. I would.
Representative Hilty incorporates it into his amendment. Further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of Representative Hilty's oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The oral amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the bill, members? We do have some. Representative Hillstrom, are you okay, or do you have some?
Mr. Chair, if you're going to lay it over and let the folks talk and bring it back tomorrow, my questions will probably be addressed if they actually talk to each other.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Westman.
Mr. Chair, with that in mind, if there is issues, I just think we can do a service to the author and the parties. Representative Hillstrom, if there's anything that you don't think is going to be addressed, let's give them 2 minutes to tell them right now, because I don't intend to have a whole committee discussion when we bring it back tomorrow, so this would be their time to get it on the record if there's an issue that you want raised, and there might be some that just aren't planning to vote for the bill anyways. We're not talking about that. We're talking about fixing things that the committee can affect.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my only real question is if the losses, I supported the amendment, thought that was the right thing to do, but if the losses happen after, but people are under the impression that the contract that they signed makes their policy a homeowner's policy, is there any notice that has to be given so people understand that what they purchased or what they think they purchased isn't what they're really going to have when we pass this new law? Because ultimately, I think the consumers have a right to know that we changed the law defining what kind of product they just, what they purchased. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wolkin, did you take note of that concern?
No, I did not. And in terms of the oral amendment, my personal view of that is that I think it's unnecessary, but I don't have any objection to it, because I think as a matter of law, there would be no way that the Supreme Court, if they certify this and take this up on appeal, would be able to take any statute that this legislature would pass and retroactively apply it to a loss.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wolkin. And Representative Davids, you'll be speaking, obviously, with Representative Hillstrom. Representative Lesh has got a burning item.
It's burning, Mr. Chair. I'll see a doctor. Mr. Chair, this is my question, and I may be regressing here. I'm hoping I'm not, but maybe it can be clarified with this. Are there other entities, organizations, or companies in the state of Minnesota that are authorized to issue combination policies other than township mutual fire insurance companies?
Mr. White or Mr. Wolkin? Mr. Marsh?
I would have to defer to Mr. Ron on that. I don't know the answer.
Okay, feel free to defer to anyone who knows.
Mr. Ron?
Thank you. If I could address that, the historical perspective, Township Mutuals, again, are very small, localized, focused industry. Part of 67A statute, it prohibits Township Mutuals from providing insurance against the perils of windstorm and hail, and in the marine coverages, liability coverages, these type of coverages. So obviously that is not a policy without those perils insured against is not a marketable commodity. So the combination policy is a product where the Township Mutual partners with companies licensed to write those perils to present the consumer with a product that incorporates the perils insured against that they need, including liability and appropriate inland marine coverages. That's where the terminology of combination policy developed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I don't think that really answered my question. It's a great description of what a combination policy is, but not who is authorized under law to issue them. So is anyone other than those township mutual companies in 67A authorized to issue them?
I don't know.
Mr. Ron and Representative Lesh, I'm going to suggest this. If Mr. Ron and others, if you would do some research overnight, and we can pick that up as well tomorrow. Is that okay with
that's okay, Mr. Chair. And I think it probably answered my questions, because if you don't know, I'm guessing the answer is probably no, because someone in here would probably, I'm guessing, would know, or if it's a very small sliver. My point is that if that's the case, then we've got this infinite loop of language between Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2, because you're saying, hang on a second, Township mutuals are excluded from having to treat policy holders as homeowners when they have a homeowner portion of the policy. And then you get into Subdivision 2, as has been stated, and says, well, hang on a second, all portions of the combination that provide homeowners insurance are subject to the provisions of 65A, which are your general property and casualty terms, which governs the total payout, has been discussed previously. So if that's the case, and if the proponents of the bill are arguing, well, we're just clarifying this, well, then what is the point of the law, the language in law that exists in 1.17 through 1.19? There's absolutely no point. I mean, there was no reason to ever put that in law in the first place if what they're stating is that this shouldn't have been in, it was mistakenly put in or something. The only way that it would be there was if there were other companies that were authorized to issue combination policies that didn't receive the special protections of Township Mutual insurance companies. If that was the case, then we say, okay, we're going to grant special protections to Township Mutuals, but not these other companies that write combination policies, because their policyholders will still receive all the protections under that language 1.17 through 1.19. So that's why I asked the question, Mr. Chair. If there's an additional answer that can be provided in a subsequent hearing, that's fine, but I think it's probably kind of already been answered.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, and the proponents of the bill bring that discussion back with them. Members, if you would save your questions for tomorrow, we'll bring it back tomorrow. At this point, members, we will lay the bill over till tomorrow's hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids and others.
Representative Abler. 2456, I think we'll start with members and members, the subcommittee, data practices subcommittee, reviewed this. I'd like to have us adopt the committee report, or at least that. Let's bring that in front of us, Mr. Gehring. What's the proper motion? Okay. The chair will move to adopt the CEH 2456 committee report. Representative Mr. Gehring, why don't you give us a recap of that? Is that all right?
So Mr. Chair, the committee report includes the amendments that were adopted in the data practices subcommittee, and you can see them all engrossed in it. So, Mr. Chair, the committee report includes the amendments that were adopted in the data practices subcommittee, and you can see them all engrossed in a new committee engrossment of the bill, which is labeled CEH 2456-1.
Representative Abler, I don't know who's best to review with us the amendments that the committee report adopted.
Mr. I have a really expert witness. I could do it all myself, but I'll just let her do it. It'll save a lot of time.
All right, let's do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Stacey Meyer with the Continuing Care Administration at the Department of Human Services. The amendment that was adopted yesterday is language we were working on as a result of feedback we received from stakeholders on the provider standards section of the language, which a few of those sections are relevant to your committee today.
And tell us, review them with us, Ms. Meyer.
Sure. House File 2456 is a proposal to create uniform standards for providers of waiver and non-waiver funded home and community-based services. This proposal creates 245D home and community-based services standards, which over the next 2 years will be a single set of standards across home and community-based services to reduce and eliminate duplicative regulation. The provisions that are relevant to this committee are in Article 1, Sections 2 and 3, which can be found on pages 4 and 5, and Section 23, which begins on the bottom of page 26 to the top of page 27. And I apologize, there is a typo on your handout that references Section 24. It is Section 23 with the committee engrossment. Article 1, Sections 2 and 3 of the bill modify Section 245A, replicates language from two sections of Minnesota rules on record retention and on electronic records. Section 2 clarifies what records must be retained and the length of time a provider must retain those records. Section 3 clarifies the use of electronic records, including electronic signatures. And adding this language to this section of statute creates consistent record standards for DHS licensed programs, whether or not they receive medical assistance funding. Article 1, Section 23 creates 245D.08 on record requirements for certain providers of home and community-based services. And this section specifies what records must be kept by a service provider, including records of current services provided and the individuals that are served, the content required for those service recipient records, which individuals have access to those records, and what personnel records must be kept, including records on employees, volunteers, and subcontractors. The content and access provisions are similar to record requirements under existing statute under Chapter 245B.07, and I have subdivisions as well if the committee is interested in those references. The other sections of 245D that reference record requirements are all stated in this section of statute under Section 23. And there are no requirements in this bill related to drug testing or civil penalties. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the comments that I have.
Thank you. Members, any questions, or can we go ahead and adopt the committee report? All those in favor of the adoption of the CEH 2456 committee report, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Abler, any comments or questions, members, to this part of the bill, which is why it's in front of us?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your attention to it. The rest of the bill we're going to keep working on.
Any other comments, Representative Scott or Holberg or Simon or Lesh? You were on the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, this bill does appear to have much controversy or issues. It's the other one that I think we have some amendments for.
Let's get to that one.
Exactly.
All right. Any other discussion on this bill? All those in favor of adopting House File 2456? The chair will move to adopt House File 2456 as amended, and we refer it to HHS Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good, Representative Abler. Next, House File 1967.
And it's the same motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The chair will move House File 1967 be recommended to pass, and we referred to the HHS Finance Committee.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
To get it, the chair will also then move the committee report CEH 1967 for adoption. And I understand there's some. Is there amendments to the committee report as well? Right. So we move the committee report. Representative Scott, let me start with you. A12 amendment.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A12 amendment, and this is just reinserting language that I pulled at our last committee meeting without full knowledge of the statute. So I'd like to reinsert that to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Okay. The A12 amendment, any discussion? All those in favor of the A12 amendment to amend the committee report, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chair, I have the A11.
Representative Holberg, the A11 amendment.
And members, I'm not sure we're exactly where we need to be. And if you look at the language on page 6 of the bill, the concern that I expressed, and I think if my memory's correct, Representative Lesch also expressed some concern about to what degree we have to share information as dictated by the federal government. And if you look on page 6, lines 3 through 5, we limited the sharing of Social Security numbers, et cetera, only to certain uses. And then if you look at what they leave there in the bill, they leave the terminology on page or on lines 2 and 3 as provided by federal law. And we had some discussion around what is mandated by federal law and what is permissive. And from my perspective, I prefer to only do what is mandated by federal law. And then if there are additional policy issues that we would then give additional permission for on a state level, I have much more comfort in that approach as opposed to allowing everything permitted by federal law and completely stepping back from any of the discretion on a state level. And so then the A11 amendment was put together to move towards the only to the extent mandated by law. And now the department may or may not be able to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. But my preference would be that we adopt the A11 amendment. And then if the department needs to get greater latitude beyond that, which is mandated by federal law, then we would put in the policy statement around that latitude that they're seeking.
Representative Lesch.
To that point, I'm in concurrence with Representative Holberg on this, too. And I think to the extent that the department needs additional latitude, that can be independently argued as a matter of policy in front of these committees, and that way we'll have full knowledge rather than just giving blanket federal authority for that. So I'd urge members to support the A11 amendment.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree. My question is, what is it that you thought you wanted to do that this language would keep you from doing? Just so we understand what tasks might be a problem.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, the department is here if they want them to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm Ann Alstrom from Child Safety and Permanency Division at the Department of Human Services. The purpose of this amendment is to enable child welfare agencies to access child support data for purposes of early identification, location, and involvement of fathers and of relatives. Generally fathers, relatives is who is appearing. That's a federal mandate. The language was actually extracted from federal regulation, which does contain a limiting set of guidance as far as what's available or not. So the purpose is to find dads early and to involve them when their children are removed from the home or involved with child welfare, and to ensure that relatives can be involved in planning and supporting their family children too. These are strong mandates in child welfare. The bind the local agency gets into is the child support arm knows something and the child welfare agency doesn't know it, and then the court says, why the heck didn't you just ask your partners about what they knew about the dad and where he was, or about relatives and where they might be? So that's the issue we're trying to resolve.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if we just put in the language that says only to the extent mandated, are you telling me that then those two agencies won't be able to talk?
There is no mandate is the problem. There's permission to share, not a requirement to share. There's a requirement to find dads. There's a requirement to look for relatives and place with relatives. There's no mandate to share the data. There's permission to share the data. There is limitation in the federal regulation as to what could be shared.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, again, I am not a big data sharer, as you're not, but Are you concerned that this would actually make it more difficult to find, you know, other family members if we're not allowing the child support office and the child welfare office to talk to each other about where family members might be?
Ms. Ahlstrom.
That was to Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'm also in committee. We also heard testimony how oftentimes child support documents contain social security numbers, et cetera, that are provided by people who actually have that information but aren't actually, it's not theirs. In other words, somebody will go and apply for child support, and they'll be asked for the social security number and private information on the other parent, and put all of this in a form not that information not being provided by the individual themselves, which is contained in these records as well. So that, you know, is kind of one nuance to this. Maybe what makes the most sense at this point is just to delete out Article 1, Section 1 of the bill at this point and have the department come with some new language that makes sense that we can talk about. I'm not sure if there's no mandate. I mean, I just want the department to clearly delineate for what purposes they want to share this information and with whom. Okay. And I don't think that in
you can add it back
9 minutes we're going to figure that out.
All right. Representative Mahoney and then
Mr. Chair and Representative
Just one second, Mr. Mahoney. Representative Mahoney, can I see if Representative Hillstrom has a follow-up?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just commenting. I don't have an issue with the A11 amendment. I just wanted to know if you were concerned about the limitation that it would be.
We'll come back to Representative Holberg's suggestion, or if we can have Representative Mahoney first talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I share Representative Holberg's concerns. I've been made aware of some of the things that slip through cracks and end up in people's files that probably shouldn't be there. What I would like to know is, I mean, it sounds like your intent is to find fathers that, you know, a child is in danger. Great idea. Love to do that. But you've come to the committee and just expected us to know what the federal rules are. We're part-time. We don't do all that. Can you, between now and the floor, find out how you put those and come to some of the committee members, particularly Representative Holberg and a couple of others, with a piece of legislation that we can add to this bill that would put those into place after you talk to us? Because I think what you're trying to do is find fathers and family relatives. We'd love that to happen because children need their dads. But we do want limitations. I wholeheartedly understand having somebody's Social Security number and driver's license number out there for everybody to share when they aren't supposed to. So can that be done in the next couple of days? And that's to the witnesses.
Representative Holstrom, Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the question was to the witnesses.
Correct.
But they did provide me with a matrix of some of the federal guidelines, but given where we are in session and our schedule, I haven't had the opportunity to digest it, if you will. So they are attempting and have been great to work with. I guess the point I'm trying to make is the A11 amendment doesn't do what they need. We don't like what they are proposing in the current bill in general. It's too much latitude. So by just deleting out Section 1 of Article 1 at this point, they can rework this, get language that does what they need to do. They have a Representative Abler's committee, I believe, this is going to before it goes to the floor. I mean, we can adopt the A11 if you want, but given that the federal government doesn't mandate any sharing, it's really pretty pointless.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, just to help this discussion along, I would suggest you adopt the amendment to kind of mess up their section. I mean, they mean well, but it's just rather than take it out, because now there's no longer a section of any kind in the bill. And so then this will create a discussion, which will be even-handed and good. And then this bill will not be heard before a week from today in my committee. And so between tomorrow and Friday and Monday, they can have some discussions. And worst case, it just reverts back to how it was in, this is going to go to conference probably, and there's an unadulterated version in the Senate. and so I think it makes it, it creates a, it keeps the discussion going, and I think it keeps the topic there. If it disappears, then there's no House position at all, which I think is not in the interest of the committee. So I would suggest you adopt the amendment, work in good faith with the department, who will absolutely work in good faith with you, because that's what they do. And then you can move on to the next.
Representative Holberg, what do you think of that suggestion? Or because Representative Holberg, let me be sure I'm clear with, if we would delete Section 1.1 that you suggested, we would not want to adopt the A11 amendment, and we would just do an oral amendment to delete that section. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, and then they'd have to come back with new language in that section of law and put it back in. But I think it's 6-1, half dozen. Either way, we know it's broken and it needs to get fixed. So in the interest of time, now that we have 4 minutes left and a couple other issues, I would do whatever the committee wants.
Representative Holberg, let me ask you directly. Are you okay with Representative Abler's suggestion, or would you prefer your suggestion?
I'm good with whatever Representative Abler wants.
Okay, and Representative Abler, department, you're okay with... we're sending you this, but we know there's a problem. You're committed to fix it with us, Ms. Alstrom?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Mahoney?
I think it's a good idea, whatever Representative Abler said.
Okay. Any more discussion on the A11 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. We have an A13 amendment as well. Representative Holberg.
Chair, I'll try and take this. And again, these are really reflective of big, huge bills, little time, second deadline week, trying to address issues that we have concerns with, and not having, what I believe to be the right solution. We were concerned that if you look at the lines that are being stricken, we want more latitude for the counties that administrate these programs to not, there's a lot of prescriptive language in how you monitor this program. They want more flexibility, and so it gets rid of all the prescriptive language. And we thought that there should be, is this the 1 year issue? I'm sorry, I'm confused. But so as far as the A13 amendment, we can put it on if you want, but there's still problems. But the standard is that if we don't specify a time period for review, it has to happen at least once a year. I think the department wants 6 months. Anoka County would prefer the latitude of a year. They're still fighting it out, and they, once again, I don't think we have peace in the valley, but this moves towards what I think we need to do. And how's that for being totally and utterly confusing?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair,
Representative Bigler.
The department says we should adopt this, and they'll continue to dialogue about this. Okay. I think on the way. So I think
Mr. Chair, I move the A13 amendment.
Representative Holberg moves the A13 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
There's a justifier too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What's the name of the testifier? Mr. Fiddler, to the adoption of the committee report as amended. Mr. Fiddler, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record. We are nearing the end of our time allotment. The intent or hope is to get this bill out today, so can you be brief and to the point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time. My name is Mark Fiddler. I was here last week, and I told the committee about some of my concerns with the A13, A12 amendment as it's configured right now. If I could back up, I'm an attorney and I've represented guardians ad litem for several years. I specialize in adoption and foster care and the Indian Child Welfare Act. I was the founder of the Indian Child Welfare Law Center back in 93, and I've handled thousands of Indian Child Welfare cases. Last October, I was before the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I represented a guardian ad litem. And in that case, the guardian ad litem had been involved in a child protection proceeding for an Indian girl. The rights were later terminated, so then we're in a second proceeding, termination of parental rights proceeding. And then when the tribe had the right in both of those proceedings to move for transfer of the case to tribal court, which I totally support. And right now, under current law, tribes do have the right to make requests for transfers of child protection proceedings. So the issue that came up in our case was the guardian opposed transfer of the case to tribal court after termination of parental rights, after the case had been in the system for over a year, and after the county had handled several other terminations for other children. And her concern was that as a guardian ad litem, if the case went into tribal court, she would be thrown off the case. The judge that knew the case for over a year at that point, knew the family history, knew the issues, that judge would not be on the case anymore. The agency which knew the case, the state agency, wouldn't be on the case. And so you have a problem of discontinuity and oversight for the case. Now, I'm not saying the tribe can't do a great job and agencies and the tribes can't do a great job and their courts can't do a great job, but when it's really hard and child protection proceedings, which last a long time, which become adoption proceedings, to just all of a sudden shift midstream. Now, there's current law that says that a case should not be transferred when it's at an advanced stage of proceedings. And the problem is under the Indian Child Welfare Act, that says that for off-reservation cases, foster care termination, those cases may be transferred to tribal court if the tribe or the parents want the case to go there and there's no objection. But what Congress did not do was they did not provide for transfers of off-reservation cases to tribal court involving proceedings after termination of parental rights. And so the issue came up, well, does federal law permit or prohibit the transfer of what is called pre-adoptive and adoptive placement proceedings? And what the 12th Amendment does is amend the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act to mandate or to provide for the transfer of those proceedings. So in the Minnesota Supreme Court, this was not the law at that time, but we argued it was prohibited. The Minnesota Supreme Court stated that state law cannot create jurisdiction in the tribal court where federal law has not. And so what this will do is pose a direct challenge to the holding of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now, I understand that proponents of the amendment think the Supreme Court was wrong, but I don't think in our system of separation of powers that when a party loses a case in the Supreme Court on an issue of federal law, that they can come to the state legislature and have the state legislature pass a law that basically repeals the decision or attempts to repeal the decision of the Supreme Court. So those are some policy.
So, Mr. Fidler, your position is against, you don't like the A-12 amendment.
Yeah, I hope that's clear.
Okay.
Yes. I have some other policy.
We're about out of time here. So, Representative Peterson, you have a question. We do have one more testifier that wants to counter Mr. Fidler's.
No, I thought we were just winding up, and he makes sense, and I'd like to hear why we should accept this amendment, because it, you know, I am not in favor of this amendment as I listen to Mr. Fidler, so.
Why don't we have Ms. Van Norman, Sarah Van Norman, come forward. Ms. Van Norman, 2 minutes. You need to keep succinct to the point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As you noted, my name is Sarah Van Norman. I am a shareholder at the Jacobson Buffalo Law Firm in St. Paul, and I am a current board member at the Iqbal Law Center that Mr. Fidler alluded to. And I speak for many Indian law practitioners that I know, in addition to, I believe, certain folks who are shareholders on the state side, and actors in the guardian ad litem's office in support of this amendment. Clearly,
and why? Tell us, get to the point. Absolutely. Why we want to support this.
Number one, this is simply putting back into place the agreement that all of the tribes in the state of Minnesota and the state itself had entered in 2007 under Governor Pawlenty's leadership. That type of agreement is absolutely authorized by the Indian Child Welfare Act, the federal law that we're looking at here. And the particular transfer provision that was challenged in that agreement in the case that Mr. Fidler alluded to is simply not illegal. The federal law just doesn't say anything about it. So, yeah, it's true, we disagree with that case, but it's a concluded Supreme Court case getting to a theme that Representative Mahoney referred to earlier. It is absolutely within the purview of this body to make state law on this point. And unless there are questions, I'll rest.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. That seems a little short. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the at least the information. And I still have questions and concerns about it.
Ms. Van Norman, are you able to follow up with Representative Peterson after this hearing, or Mr. Fidler? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the proponents of this amendment are saying that if, for whatever reason, a child's a parent's parental rights have been terminated, they haven't been involved for 6 months or a year, and a decision has been made, and you've got judges and attorneys and guardians ad litem all involved in the child's case, we're going to take that whole body of work, throw it out the window, and start over again? Is that what we're doing here?
Ms. Van Norman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, actually we're not. Because the key provision that addresses that late transfer issue that is reasonably an issue in cases like this where you have concurrent jurisdiction, questions of where a case should actually be heard and concluded, the provision that you're looking at includes, and this is in the language that's already in the statute, at line 4, about halfway through, in the absence of good cause to the contrary, shall transfer. The court shall transfer if there's not good cause. Good cause has long been...
I'm not fine. Where are you at?
Oh, I'm sorry. It is, if you go down to line 4 of subdivision 3, and move over to the middle of the line, it says, the court, in the absence of good cause to the contrary, shall transfer the proceeding. Now, that's very important language. We have a lot of case law in this state and elsewhere to look to that tells us that good cause to the contrary may include that a case is simply too far advanced to transfer. So we handle that in another way already. This provision, the amendment to this particular subdivision, is really just about something else. I don't believe that it's legitimately
so
about late stage.
Ms. Van Norman, you're under the, members on the 812 amendment. Mr. Reynolds says it's lines 1.8, 1.9. You're saying good cause could be shown that if you're a year down the road, you've got all these people involved. That would be a reason the court should not transfer. If they can't show good cause and it, everybody says it makes sense to transfer, the transfer should be done.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. What it does is essentially preserve the right of the court to decide on a case-by-case basis in these very different, factually different scenarios when and if a transfer should be denied.
Okay. And Mr. Fidler, why don't you come up here if you have any counter to that, and we're going to be brief about this. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, there is law on good cause to the contrary, and advanced stage is one of the criterion. However, under a Court of Appeals case, what the Court of Appeals looks at is the separate proceedings. So you've got a foster care, a termination, pre-adoptive, and adoptive placement proceedings. So when you get into each new proceeding, the advanced stage analysis basically ticks over. So under you have a different advanced stage analysis. So a county could be involved, and a court could be involved for the entire CHIPS case, the TPR case, and then the tribe, under existing law, has the right to say, no, it's not advanced because we're in the very early stage of a new proceeding.
So, Mr. Fidler, you're saying that they should look at the totality of the circumstances, i.e., if there's multiple things going, they should somehow look at them together?
You have to look at...
Ms. Norman, you're saying not?
Well, Your Honor, Chairman, you can tell where I end up appearing regularly. We simply have dealt with that issue already and do it separately as a matter of federal and state law. That's really not what's at issue here, those different separate proceedings. What's at issue here is whether or not the state wants to support the policy of transfers in pre-adoptive and adoptive placements. And the state has already said yes. That was the agreement, again, that the state and tribes reached, and that's basically the end of this particular provision.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, did you have a follow-up? Otherwise,
I'm
no, you're fine.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and the witnesses. I kind of, you know, I've spent 10 years involved with, you know, not on the committee of Mr. Abler, Representative Abler, dealing with children in separation from parents. And one of the biggest complaints is that new judges or new lawyers or everybody else gets in the middle of it 3 months, 6 months, a year and a half down the road. I'd be very comfortable with this amendment if it's included or it's explicit that all proceedings are under the that exemption, that good cause. So if you can't come in after 6 months or after the CHIPS or the termination and say, okay, now we're in a new proceeding here. We're in a brand new proceeding, so now our falls into place. Taking the totalitarian, I guess I'm having the same problem the chair is, when you're deciding that particular function. Because I am worried that all of a sudden you're redoing something with a kid and you're sticking them, or him or her, after everything's been done, all of a sudden it all starts over again, and this little kid is the becomes the target, not the problem.
Mr. Fidler, Ms. Van Norman, are we talking two different things here, or are you guys in agreement on that kind of point?
Your Honor, there I did it. Mr. Chair, Representative of the committee.
Real brief.
The law is per se that it is an advanced stage. Once there's a termination of parental rights, there's a Montana Supreme Court case that said after termination, it is per se an advanced stage.
Ms. Van Norman, what do you say?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, you know, I'm not looking to Montana law in this circumstance. We're looking at Minnesota law, and we share the concerns Representative Mahoney has raised about these issues that typically arise, and frankly, ICWA cases often get drawn out more than other types of child welfare cases because of the different interests involved. We try to address them, and we will continue to, we're committed to continuing to work with this particular language to the extent needed.
Representative Abler, and then Chair, I'm going to have some direction.
This is Representative Allen's amendment that came out on the Health Reform Committee, and she's very knowledgeable on this question. I suggest that maybe Representative Mahoney and others talk to her and work out some, if they need some comfort language to make it work. I think it's a good amendment, and I think it solves a problem. So for today, if this could go forward, this bill is going to my committee, and perhaps they can come to some language that makes sense if they need to. So
that was what I was going to recommend. Representative Mahoney, would you be comfortable with talking with Representative Allen, and if we need to fix some things? Sure. I think you and I are expressing the same concern. We maybe should circle with Representative Allen, and I think the committee members might lean in that direction. So if you're okay with that, Mr. Fidler, Ms. Van Norman, I want you to stay engaged in this. We would like to work on any comfort language or express language if we need it between now and Representative Abler's committee and the floor for sure. Is that okay? Mr. Fidler?
Of course, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Van Norman?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. And members, we need to adopt the committee report, and then we'll renew the motion. But all those in favor of the adoption of the committee report as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now to the renewal of the adoption of House File 1967. Any further discussion? Having none, Representative, the chair renews his motion for passage of House File 1967 as amended to the HHS Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Members, tomorrow we've got a committee at 12:30. If you noticed, meeting is adjourned until then.